Good afternoon and welcome everyone to the Respectability Volunteer Training Webinar for June 20th, 2018. My name is Philip Khanpali. I am the Policy and Practices Director for Respectability. And for a change, I'm not here to talk to you about policy, necessarily. I'm not necessarily here to talk to you about best practices, but I'm actually here to talk about you. If you're attending today's webinar, it means that you signed up as a potential volunteer for Respectability's brand new, out of the box for the first time ever, volunteer corps. The idea that we have going on is that we have so much work we have to do. There is so much need out there in terms of advancing jobs for people with disabilities that we're constantly getting messages from people in communities across the country who say, I want to get involved. I want to help you do your work. Great. Now we're trying to make that into a reality. So today you're going to be joining us to talk to several of our board members who have really deep experience around advocating and educating on disability issues, who are going to give you some insights in terms of what you can do to empower people with disabilities into the workplace. This is an experiment, I have to tell you right off the bat. This is the first time we've actually used our webinars as an interactive training opportunity. So how this is going to go is I'm going to introduce you to our board members. We're going to go through a bunch of slides on a bunch of different topics. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the workforce ideas we have for what you can do to help us. Then we're going to open it up to questions. So there'll be a chance for you to ask questions about how much time you got to commit to this, what you're going to get involved, how you're going to be recognized for making serious contributions to our efforts, and I'll have the tremendous opportunity to introduce you to our volunteer coordinator, who from now on is going to be your point of contact for pitching in on Respectability's mission of fighting stigmas and advancing opportunities. So first and foremost, I want to introduce you to one of Respectability's great board members, Steve Bartlett. Steve Bartlett is a former congressman, former mayor, and tremendous advocate and ally for people with disabilities across the country. He's joining us today to offer his insights as a lawmaker, as an advocate, giving us our perspective on what it takes to be a successful advocate and how to support independence for all people with disabilities. So, Steve Bartlett.
So with that drum roll, I'll take it away from there, Philip, right?
Yes, please.
Okay, so nice to meet you all by webinar in any event. Let me start with I want to thank the people on this call for what you are doing and, more importantly, what you are about to do because you, across the country with grassroots help, you can make a huge difference in the understanding and the clarity and the knowledge base of both elected officials and candidates, and you will move the needle. So this is a serious proposal, and it can only be implemented by you, and thank you for that. My own role is I've been in elected office three times. I was a Dallas City Councilman for an at-large seat in the City of Dallas. I was a member of the U.S. Congress representing Dallas for 8 years, and I was mayor of Dallas. And in that, the life of an elected official is a public life, and so you need to know that. Elected officials, whether it's school board or legislators or congressmen or mayors or city council, they really do get a joy from hearing from their constituents and learning. So this is not something that they will resist. This is something that the elected officials will actually want to hear from you because they learned something from it. When I was in Congress, I had 18 public town halls every year. When I was mayor, I had 60 or so public hearings every year. When I was a city councilman, I had 12 town halls every year. And getting people to come to those town halls was, I had town halls in which only three people showed up, and I had town halls in which 250. And it kind of depends on what's happening in the public at the time. So for you to go to an event will really make a difference. So I'm going to walk through some how-to, and then I'll turn it back over to Philip, and then we'll be able to take questions at the end. First, what you say does matter. The information that you transmit and the way you transmit it will affect the thinking of an elected official. You can't ask for an elected official to just simply hear what you have to say and say, okay, you're so smart, I'll just agree with you and I'll do it the way you say it. So what you're really looking for is a greater understanding of stigmatizing of jobs, of job opportunities, of independence for disability. You're looking for a better understanding on their part than they might have had in the beginning. So you take every elected official kind of wherever they are, and you begin to develop that understanding. So what you say does matter. It will change the mindset of elected officials all over the country. More importantly, what you don't say also matters, meaning that the only people that get heard in democracy are the people that speak up. So if we don't speak up, then we don't get heard, and our side of the story of independence just never gets told. So here's how you do it. First of all, you look, and I'll give you some suggestions. You put yourself in front of an elected official, and there are several places to be in front of them, but you want to be in front of them. You want to have as close to a personal relationship as you can in terms of communicating to where they see you, they hear what you have to say, and they then listen and respond to it. So the way to do that, there are basically three different avenues, and you can do all three. One is what's called a town hall. And a town hall are those events, usually at a school or an auditorium or a recreation center, in which the elected official has the hall. They put out notices for the public to show up. You call the district office or their office, and you ask them, when are your next town halls? And you pick one and you go to it. It's always better if you have two or three people going together, but it doesn't have to be. You can go by yourself. So that's called a town hall. The town hall, what happens is the elected official makes some preliminary comments and then takes questions. So you don't want to be the first question, but you want to be in the first three, because other people will have something to say, and you want to be sure that you get focused. You don't want to be the first question because it makes you look too eager. So you want to be somewhere in about the third question or something like that. Just raise your hand, stand up, and tell them what's on your mind. The flip side to a town hall, and I call the Rotary Club. So elected officials will speak to all kinds of civic organizations, Rotary Clubs, PTAs, school, all kinds of situations. So again, ask the district office, ask their office, do you have any public meetings coming up that I can attend as a guest? And they either will or they won't, and they'll either tell you they won't, or it'll be on the website. The third way is you literally can make an introduction to the office, to the staff director of the office, and ask if you can visit with the congressman. I'm just taking this would be a congressman, also could be a city council. If you can visit with them for about 15 minutes in their office. Just say, I have some issues on disability issues I want to share. And oftentimes they will set up a time for you to come in and say your piece, and you just go in and you have about 15 minutes. Sometimes 30, but you should plan on about 15 minutes. Just say what's on your mind. And the third way is a campaign event when they're running for election or running for re-election. And I'm going to put that off for a minute and come back to how to do that. So what you do is you get there early. You want to get to the event 15 minutes in advance. Find a place to sit. Don't sit in the back. You don't have to sit on the front row, but sit somewhere in the center. So it's easier to see you, and in the first two or three rows, and then when the congressman or the councilman says, okay, any questions, then you basically, in a very friendly way, you ask a question, try to make it a general question that they can answer. You know, you don't want to say, how do you stand on H.R. 2222, because that'll embarrass them. They may not know what H.R. 2222 is. But just ask them some generalized questions on what is your view about jobs for people with disabilities. And then at that point, you can also express your view on what ought to be done better or different on that issue. You got about 30 seconds to ask the question, no more than that. Really, if you can ask a question in 15 seconds, that's even better. You usually don't get a chance to ask a follow-up question, although sometimes the congressman will say, explain that to me, or what do you suggest? In other words, you can sometimes get a dialogue going, but you don't want to dominate it because there are other people in the audience that are waiting to get their question in. Listen to the answer. Don't write it down while they're talking, but just listen carefully to the answer and then write down some notes as to what they said. And then after the meeting, go and you will see somebody on the congressman's staff our councilmen or school board members. Somebody is staff. They'll be the ones that will be scurrying around setting things up. And walk up and introduce yourself. Just say, are you you work for the congressman? Yes. And then try to get his business card and give your card, okay? And that way you have some contact information. And also you can then follow up with an email to the staff member to say, I want to emphasize what I said at the meeting. So that kind of nails it down. Now you want to do this in a non-confrontational way, in a friendly way. You do not want to assume, regardless of what you may think or may know to be true about the congressman's voting record, you don't want to assume that he's against you. You just want to you want to treat it as a blank slate. So you're trying to educate, you're trying to inform, and you just assume goodwill on their part. And there will be goodwill. So you don't have, whether or not they vote the way you want them to is a lot of different factors that goes into it. So assume goodwill. Your job is to educate. Then we move from there to a campaign event. So a campaign event is currency of the realm. That's where members of Congress, the best kind of campaign event is what's called a campaign coffee, where someone will host the congressman in their home and invite their neighbors. So you call the campaign office for those and you say, I want to attend a campaign event. Do you have one coming up? Not a fundraiser. You don't have to pay money. Just say, do you have one coming up? Most of them do. And if not, then that's their loss. But then go to the event and do exactly the same thing, except it'll be more of a social occasion. And they'll stand around and talk for a little while informally before the speech and then the questions. You'll also get to ask a question. I would encourage you to do both. A campaign event, you'll find the congressman is more relaxed. He or she will know that they're among friends and will be more inclined to listen. So you actually want to do both. We've talked about what to advocate, and respectability will send you information. It needs to be, you don't want it to be too specific, but you don't want it to be too general, but have a pretty good idea as to what you want them to do as a result of the conversation. Make it personal. If you then have a chance to give a 15 or 20 second version of your story, how you got where you are, what you've done in your life that is significant, especially on the independence level, that makes it personal and that really helps. And then after the meeting, please report in, send respectability a report on who you talked to. Send the staff member that you talked to the business card, what you said and what the congressman said, and that gives us a lot of information that we can use on the national level. It's fun. You'll be exhilarated of the involvement, and you will make a huge difference in the way they think. So thank you in advance, and you're going to really enjoy this.
Thank you so much. Sir, we really appreciate your insights and your perspective, and we want to encourage everybody in our audience to really take home that message that this is something that they can do, and that this is something that we will work with you to do. So thank you so much again, sir. And so digging in a little bit on terms of, you know, what is advocacy and how to advocate and, you know, what are some of the pathways I want to encourage folks to think about. So we touched on the political piece. We've touched on the policy piece a little bit. But I want to actually call on Donna Meltzer, who's from our Board of Advisors and is the CEO of a tremendous organization that is a great partner of Respectability and can be a great opportunity for you to get involved. So Donna Meltzer is the CEO of the National Association of Councils on Developmental Disabilities. It's a national organization that represents the nation's gubernatorially appointed DD councils. She's been actively involved in the CCD, which is the big national disability organization, as well as a variety of other tremendously important disability advocacy opportunities. She is an old hand in the town, but she has moved mountains for the sake of the 1 in 5 Americans who have disabilities. Isn't that right, Donna?
I'm not sure about the old hand there.
Oh. I meant it as a compliment.
I totally get it. Thank you. Just adding a little levity to what is honestly quite a serious conversation. So thank you for inviting me to join in today and to be able to speak with everybody. I want to thank everybody who is on the phone line today and following this webinar. This is a great opportunity, and as Congressman Bartlett pointed out, taking that opportunity to really be an advocate, to give time, take that time away from your jobs, your families, other things that fill your life, to be able to speak up as an advocate is critically important. Philip, can you move the slide to the so I want to talk today about the importance of advocacy, and if you can move that along. Perfect. Thank you. So I personally feel, as does my organization, that it's critically important for people with disabilities to advocate for themselves, and we call that self-advocacy. Not everybody is so thrilled with that term. Some people really love the term self-advocacy, and others not as much. That all advocacy is advocacy, whatever you want to call it, it's just important that you take that opportunity to speak up and speak out about things that you care about, things that are important to you, what your needs are, and the needs of others as well. In my organization, Philip mentioned, I represent the nation's 56 councils on developmental disabilities. Those councils exist in federal statute. They come out of the Developmental Disabilities Assistance and Bill of Rights Act. It was initially signed into law back in the early 1960s. Most recently, it was reauthorized in the year 2000. It's Public Law 106402. Why I mention that today is because that law includes a very important mandate for our councils on developmental disabilities, or DD councils, as we more affectionately refer to them. That mandate says that our 56 DD councils must support opportunities for individuals with developmental disabilities who are considered leaders, to provide leadership training to individuals with DD who may become leaders. So kind of that train the trainer kind of idea. So through our DD councils, we identify, or people identify for themselves, that they see themselves as leaders and want to learn how to become a trained advocate who will also take on the responsibility of training others to become advocates. I want to talk for just a quick moment about self-advocacy and that term, and what does it really mean? We talk about it in terms of three different ways that you can be an advocate. As a self-advocate, you can advocate for your own needs. Many of us learned as early as childhood how to advocate for our own needs. We might have gone to teachers or to our parents or to neighbors to ask about things that we needed. As we mature, we tend to think also about advocating not only for ourselves, but for others as well, who might have similar cares, similar concerns, care about similar issues. So that's kind of a more involved aspect of advocating. And then there's the third level of advocacy, which is advocating to change larger systems and create policy change. That is when we can go beyond just looking at our own needs or maybe the needs of ourselves and some of our friends or family members, but really looking at big change that is needed within our society. I'm sure each of you who's listening in on this call today can think about change needs that you have in the communities where you live. It might be around better transportation or better housing opportunities, or how your schools work to include children with disabilities. So when we can get to that level of advocating to change larger systems, we've really hit on the big picture of self-advocacy. Next slide, please. So as I mentioned, the DD councils are established in law, and the council itself is a body of individuals who are appointed by the governor of each state and territory of the U.S. 60%, at least 60% of the people who serve on that council must be people with developmental disabilities or family members. So that is a potential way that some of you might already be involved. If I was in a room with you, I'd be looking at you and asking if you could identify if you're familiar with the DD council that is in your state or territory. Unfortunately, on the phone, that's harder to do, but I would bet that some of you are already familiar with your DD council. The DD councils work through public policy and advocacy to make communities more welcoming and accessible for people with disabilities to live, to learn, to work, and to play in a very inclusive manner. We educate and we inform policymakers at all levels about the needs of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities and, and the broad population of people with disabilities. And then we look for innovative solutions to fix those problems. We work collaboratively. It's kind of like what the congressman was explaining just a few moments ago about how people need to come together and speak up about issues and sit down with their members of Congress, whether that's their federal members of Congress or it's at the state legislature or maybe it's at a town council level. Whatever level it's at, it's just important that you speak up and talk about what's important to you. Next slide, please. I want to give you a very brief example of how developmental disabilities councils work to solve problems in their innovative way. So my quick example is about a city in Florida, a well-known city, a large area of Florida, where the council identified through surveying the population of people that they had a very big problem around transportation. I think all of us who work in the disability space that know having accessible transportation is key to living life in the community. What this particular area had was some accessible cabs and buses, but most of all, you had to schedule them well in advance, and they only operated in a certain radius and only on certain days. Well, we can't live a truly meaningful and full life if we can't get to the places where we need to go. So the DD Council serves as that convening place, that team of people that could bring together government, people from the state government, from the Florida Department of Transportation, from the town's transportation systems, the council members, and private entities like cab companies and bus companies and others. And they work through a series of conversations to have everybody first learn together what are the needs of people? Where do people need to go? When do they need to get there? Is it to get to work? Is it to get to the shopping mall? Is it to get to church or synagogue or mosque on a weekend? Or what are those needs? And so once the assessment was done, then the planners could come together to really look about at how they could work collaboratively to change the transportation system in their city area and make sure that it would work. And in the end, they came up with a terrific system that worked off of vouchers with private cab companies where people did not have to order a cab 48 hours in advance, but there was a whole new fleet of accessible cabs that was available 24/7, that was available at a very nominal cost and had a much larger radius of where it was they were willing to drive and get people to the places that they wanted and needed to go. So that's just a short snapshot of how councils innovate solutions. The point that I want you all to take away from that is there had to be people that they reached out to say, what are your needs? You are those kinds of people who should be letting the DD Council know that you're out there, that you are willing to share information and talk about what your needs are. Next slide, please. So I mentioned that the DD councils are appointed by the governor. So clearly not everybody is going to be able to serve on a DD council. And I recognize that some of you on this phone call may identify as having a developmental disability, something that you've had since childhood and is going to last throughout your lifetime and affect three or more major life areas. Some of you have broader disabilities. But I do want you to know that the DD councils host lots of community-based programs and forums on various topics where all people can come and weigh in. Again, much like the congressman was talking about, the DD Council will hold capital days or town hall meetings or open up opportunities for people to join in teams and to go to meet with legislators and to talk about their needs and concerns. So sometimes it might be with members of the state legislature. Sometimes it might be with members of our federal government, our congressmen and representatives and senators. Sometimes it will be with the governor or the lieutenant governor. So we have lots of opportunities available. Next, please. So the DD Council's support with their staff, with funding and other volunteer opportunities, statewide and local self-advocacy organizations. These are organizations that work to develop an advocacy agenda. So again, you heard the congressman talking earlier about that importance of going to your policymakers, whatever level they're at, and being able to talk about particular issues of the day. In fact, he gave you a great tip, right? Don't just talk about, oh, in HR 2425, it says that, and that policymaker might not be very familiar with that particular bill number. But through these statewide self-advocacy organizations, they work to become very educated, to develop a policy agenda that they then work to bring to educate local boards, committees, and policymakers around a whole host of issues, including things like housing, healthcare, education, and transportation. Self-advocacy organizations also have a very important role in teaching leadership skills to advocates so that they can be effective and authentic voices in their communities and showcase that people with disabilities can and, in fact, must be part of planning in their community. And that is something that we focus a lot on through our DD councils and through statewide and local self-advocacy organizations, is being part of that team of people who will speak up and keep disability on the minds of others who are always working within your local cities and towns. Let me give you a quick example on that. So in my own community, a park recently, it was announced that this park was going to be undergoing a huge renovation. So as soon as I heard that, my first question was, will there be people with disabilities who will be on the planning committee to look at making that park fully accessible? Well, I didn't know the answer, but I picked up the phone and I called the director of the Maryland DD Council. And he said, oh, we're right on it. We have people who live in that county and they are our local representatives and they are serving on that planning committee to make sure that as the planners work to update that park, it will be keeping in their minds the needs of people with all kinds of disabilities. That's exactly the kind of system we're looking to create. Next slide, please. So many of our councils actually sponsor advocacy training programs. Some are for adults with disabilities and for family members and for professionals. Some are even for teenagers or young adults. Some of you might even be familiar with some of these training programs. There's a longstanding, excellent training program called Partners in Policymaking. It was developed in the late 1980s, and it exists in many states and territories across our country. It's a great opportunity to join in a class where typically there are maybe 6 or 8 sessions spread out over a number of months, and typically they are on weekends, keeping in mind that many people during the week have jobs and families to care for. But it's a great way to come together with other people with disabilities and to learn kind of the history of disability policy and how does this law interact with that law, et cetera, et cetera, and to learn those real skills and practice those skills with each other for how do you go into a member's office and have a conversation? How do you ask for language in a bill that might be very important to an issue that you are working on? So I do encourage you, if this is of interest to you, to check on your state's DD Council website and see if they are supporting either a Partners in Policymaking class or something similar. Some of them have other names. But there are also wonderful opportunities for young leaders through the Young Leadership Forum, also sponsored mostly by Developmental Disabilities Councils. And there are other school-based trainings. So, for example, the Close Up Washington program is a long-established, very well-known training program for students all across America with and without disabilities. And it's an excellent way for young people who are honing their skills, thinking that maybe someday they'll be leaders in their communities, can learn all about how Washington works and learn those skills and take those skills back home. Many DD councils are also helping to make sure that people with disabilities know their rights and responsibilities in their civic communities, including in the election process. We do partner with other disability organizations, including Respectability and AAPD, the American Association for People with Disabilities, and the RevUp program, and lots of others to make sure that we have lots of information available on how to participate in the election process. I did want to just note two resources that might be of interest to you if you are really looking to upgrade your advocacy opportunities. One is that we at NACDD launched in 2015 a website for people who are people with disabilities who want to be leaders in advocacy. It is called Start Your Journey, and it's at www.startyourjourney.org. And at the center of that website is a book. It's called The Art of Impact, a handbook for living a self-determined life. And this is a kind of a how-to manual of how to be a self-advocate. And it was written by and for people with disabilities. Also on that website, we have other resources and profiles on a number of people who are part of our leadership here at NACDD who are people with developmental disabilities who wanted to share information about themselves and the type of advocacy work that they are doing. So I hope you'll get a chance to take a look at those materials, and I hope that they will inspire you or at least give you more materials that you might want to print out and use in your life and throughout the time that you will be working as an advocate. The other resource I just wanted to quickly note is called onevotenow.org, and that is a website that is all about how to participate in our election process. It is nonpartisan. It is simply about how to understand and know what resources are out there for you. If you need to understand more about how to participate as a person with a disability or assisting other people with disabilities to participate in the most important thing that exists in our democracy, which is the ability to vote for your elected leaders. So those are some of the ways that NACDD is offering ways for self-advocates to connect. Again, it's not so important whether you connect through a DD council. That's just one mechanism. Clearly, all of you on this call are going to be connecting through Respectability. You may already be connected through other entities in your state or wherever you live, and that is wonderful as well. It will just bring more to this great opportunity that you are embarking on, which is to really become an army of advocates who are willing to speak up and share so that we can together make change in our country. Philip, I will turn it back to you at this time, and I'm, of course, happy to answer questions later in our program.
Thank you so much, Donna, and we really consider NACDD and the DD Councils to be a tremendous partner of Respectabilities and a really great way to get involved with these issues. Go to their website to learn more, and when it comes to advocacy opportunities or these kinds of connections, reach out to the team here at Respectability. We're always happy to do an e-connect between somebody living in a state and other people living in that state. And we'll go into the detail on a lot of those connections and questions when we get to our Q&A section. So next, I want to bring up the last member of our board of directors who is in attendance today, and it is the peerless advocate, educator, and all in all, workforce dynamo, who is Janet Labreck. Janet Labreck has lived and breathed vocational rehabilitation, disability employment for years, coming out of Massachusetts. She has been a tremendous asset to people with disabilities across the country. Most recently, she served as the commissioner of the Rehabilitation Services Administration under the Department of Education back during the Obama administration. What that means is that she was principally responsible for driving efforts around something called WIOA. If you've been following Respectability for a while, you probably have heard the term WIOA a good number of times. And so Janet is going to be joining us today to talk about the workforce system, what is involved, what's going on with the law. And then from there, we'll go into detail about some of the things that we hope that you, as a new volunteer corps, you'll actually get involved and get to doing. So Janet, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Philip, for the introduction, and also thanks to the other board members who are participating today. All these topics are very informative and incredibly important for both volunteers as well as for the disability community. So thank you for your efforts as well and willingness to support the disability community. My previous role as commissioner for the Rehabilitation Services Administration brought me into a system just in time to reauthorize the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 as amended by the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, as Philip mentioned. And that piece of legislation was really important to not only the disability community, but to employers as well as to partners who work alongside of the programs that provide vocational rehabilitation services to individuals with disabilities nationally. And the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, that piece of legislation was so critical and timely, probably overdue, because it was a significant piece of legislation that was promulgated, certainly implemented by Congress and promulgated by the Rehabilitation Services Administration in partnership with the disability community partners, key stakeholders, and educators, multiple communities involved. And it was the piece of legislation during that enactment, which was on July 22nd, 2014, that was a bipartisan, bicameral piece of legislation brought forward to support the disability community and to change the way that the system has historically delivered services to the disability community. But equally important, it was an opportunity to look at the system itself and how we not only provide services to the disability community, but moving forward, our nation's workforce has transitioned from the various skills that are critical for individuals to have in the workforce, not just the disability community, but in the general workforce at large, but specifically for the disability community to have the opportunity to catch up and to have access to information, training programs, how those training programs are actually delivered, resources that can better inform and support the endeavors that individuals with disabilities often have as they are seeking to develop their skill set and enter into the nation's labor workforce as productive citizens who, in fact, do want to contribute. And this is important, obviously, because individuals with disabilities can, in fact, contribute to the nation's workforce. And I think that the other thing, the other important item to note about WIOA also is that this piece of legislation really gave the opportunity to both unify and certainly be more inclusive of the process itself of providing services and supports, you know, to individuals with disabilities as they are striving to determine their own future and identify the specific career goals and pathways that they would like to engage in. And I can remember, you know, as a young person and being diagnosed with an eye condition called retinitis pigmentosa, it took me a long time to even be able to say the word, but also it was important for me because I remember receiving that diagnosis, and I remember thinking very specifically as a young adolescent, what am I going to be able to do as work, and am I, in fact, going to be able to work? And that I never saw myself as somebody who could not contribute, but I had no idea about how I could contribute, what skills would be critical for me to have in order to be a productive citizen. And so I think that this legislation really gave the opportunity to look at the system as a whole, how it delivered services to individuals with disabilities, and most importantly, who those partnerships are. So this piece of legislation also focused on not only providing services and supports in a different way and preparing individuals with disabilities differently for the labor workforce in the 21st century economy, but it also looked at who the partners were engaged in this process. And we have multiple systems that provide services oftentimes to the same individuals with disabilities who may be receiving services from different systems. So this piece of legislation really gave the opportunity to streamline how agencies and partners work together in order to really look at comprehensive reform in the vocational rehabilitation programs. And so individuals in the disability community, stakeholders, teachers, the business community are all partners in this process, as well as the federal agencies that oversee different programs like the Department of Health and Human Services and the U.S. Department of Labor, who all have programs that specifically work with various agencies and programs and individuals with disabilities. So this piece of legislation helps to really streamline and unify how those services are actually being delivered and how they're being received and who are partners in this actual process as well. And I have to say that it was important, to note that organizations like Respectability, for example, were really critical partners in this process as an organization also, and as we really strive to take this piece of legislation that was important to diversifying and making a more inclusive system of service delivery. And actually, Respectability was also really critical in making the decision to comment on all the state unified or combined state planning process, which was important to hear and have that feedback demonstrated by Respectability as well as by other organizations as well. And I think that that was important because the state plans really drive how the agencies as well as their partners are going to work together to change the system of delivering these services and training programs to individuals with disabilities. So the data and testimony that was provided by Respectability as part of that process, I think, was really critical in states like New York, as well as in other states, for the purpose of understanding how these services were going to be delivered. But not only that, challenging the states to also be creative and innovative in their approach. And so Respectability played a critical role in helping to point out ways that these states could certainly deliver services in a more comprehensive and innovative process as well as collaborative.
Well, thank you so much, Janet. I want to interject and just add a little context for some of our folks in terms of, all right, so we got this WIOA, it's a big law, there's state plans. What does that mean locally? And I just want to kind of fill in a little bit. So this law was passed in 2014. In 2016, each state had to submit, as Janet talked about, a state plan. And so that plan outlines what a state is specifically going to do to improve their workforce system, how they're going to train people, how they're going to prepare youth for jobs of the future. And the people that are critically responsible for getting those plans implemented at the local level is something called a Workforce Development Board. There are hundreds of workforce boards across the country, and we are encouraging folks who have an interest in this particular issue to go to their local workforce board and find out, what are they working on? How are they investing their money? What are they doing to support job seekers with disabilities? And see, here's the thing is, working with Janet at RSA, we looked at all these plans. We came up with a lot of ideas, but now that it's been a few years since the law was passed and states are doing what they're doing, they're now thinking about, well, what can we do next? Or what new initiatives can we undertake? And so our partners at the local level, our new volunteers, are going to be out there, encouraging those boards to take on projects to support youth with disabilities. If you want to know more about your local workforce system, there is a website called careeronestop.org that can help you find out where is your local board, when do they meet. A lot of local areas have something called a youth council that specifically coordinates and connects youth programs. That's a great opportunity to get involved because legally, these boards and agencies have to have public meetings. And at public meetings, it's a chance for you to go out there to represent these issues and to get partners on board.
And I think, Philip, also, I think another important aspect of this is that focusing on the youth particularly, because this piece of legislation, and this is where your volunteers can be very helpful as well, because WIOA mandates that each state set aside a minimum of 15% of their state grant allotments that they receive for the purposes of preparing youth with disabilities for training as well as employment opportunities. And so there is that opportunity there that's in place for states to engage through partnerships to develop innovative and creative opportunities for training programs, initiatives, things like looking at internship opportunities, apprenticeship opportunities, after school job training, certainly training in the STEM area, which is one of those very important areas today in our labor workforce. And so as volunteers locally, you have the opportunity to connect with these workforce boards as well as connect with the VR agency specifically, you know, to ensure that you have the opportunity to be clear about it, but also to make recommendations about, you know, specific initiatives or trainings that they may not be familiar with or ideas that you can partner with the workforce board as well as the VR agencies, because they're required now to work together as partners in this whole process. And so it's really, really valuable to have your certainly expertise and certainly as you go along learning in the process about ways that you can offer support both to the programs as well as to the disability community to ensure that level of engagement and thought process and to follow along to make sure that there are opportunities that are being taken advantage of for the purposes of ensuring that individuals with disabilities are not only the recipient, but they're also active participants both in the decision-making as well as the planning process and as well as in the policy development process. You heard our other two presenters today talk about advocacy, policy development, systems change. These are all critical and very valuable areas where you can be play an important role in helping to make sure that your voice is heard, make sure that the disability community's voice is heard, and that there are various levels of engagement, as well as with the employer community, because they are an incredibly important partner now in this process as well. And if we don't have those partnerships and those relationships developed, then it's highly unlikely that individuals with disabilities who, in fact, do want to become productive citizens, and over three quarters of individuals with disabilities report that they want to work in this field of policy or disability, and that they want to work in general. It is a myth that people with disabilities do not want to work. They want to contribute. They need the support. They need the guidance. They need the skills development. They need advocacy. They need your voice, most importantly, to help with speaking to policymakers, to employers, to key stakeholders, to educators, so that the story is, in fact, told and that your engagement in the whole process, throughout the process, is really important.
Thank you so much, Janet. I really appreciate it. And I want to actually kind of pivot and talk about, so we've talked about very high-minded, you know, what is involved with all of these things. And so I want to focus really in on something very specific, something very concrete that we're hoping that our volunteers can undertake. So we talked about reaching your policymakers. We talked about getting involved with your local board. We talked a little bit, thank you, Janet, about the stigma that employers have around hiring people with disabilities. Well, one of the simplest, easiest, and best ways to get it to start changing those attitudes and opinions is to get your views, to get our ideas out there in the printed word or on a website. And so one of the things that we're really encouraging our volunteer corps to do is to write op-eds. The whole idea of a letter to the editor is something that appears in your local newspaper is a little old-fashioned, but you know what? It gets that message out there. It's an opportunity to make your voice be heard. It's a chance to educate the broader public with facts. I know facts are really hard to come by these days, but they're critically important all the same. And most importantly, you know, the more often people hear positive things about the talents and skills of people with disabilities, the more likely people are to change their behavior. And so one of the things we'd love for you as a volunteer for Respectability to do would be to contact your local paper and find out, hey, I have a story about hiring a person with a disability or empowering my son with an internship. What can I do to get that story published? And some of the critical things you need to have to write a good op-ed is to have something called a message triangle. And this is that super fancy strategic communication stuff we do here in D.C. And so the idea is you need to have three concrete ideas in your op-ed that really communicate the message you want to share. We want our volunteers to going out there and sharing the idea of equality, the idea that our nation was founded on the principle that anyone who works hard should get ahead in life, the idea that people with disabilities want to work and that people with disabilities can be a tremendous asset to their employers. It's also important to celebrate success. If you know of a local company that is actually hiring people with disabilities, write about them. Talk about what they're doing. Take pictures and put it out on social media. Otherwise, you know, big name companies like EY, JPMorgan Chase, and Coca-Cola all are doing great things for hiring people with disabilities. And it shows that if we can find the right jobs, it can and will increase the company's bottom line. On Respectability's website, you'll find a tremendous resource under our Policymakers tab. So the website is respectability.org, and if you see resources, click on that, and then scroll down a little bit, and you'll find Policymakers. So Janet and Donna talked about some of our past work at the state level. Maybe you need to know how many people have disabilities in your state. Maybe you want to know how many people have jobs or some ideas around best practices. Well, go to our website. Go to the Policymakers tab and search for your state's information. This slide, I apologize, it's a little hard to see, but it's a complete breakdown of every state in the union and some statistics that you can download and put to use in your work. As I said, an op-ed should communicate the facts, but it needs to be simple. Do not use jargon. It's especially important if you have personal experience with disabilities that you write about it. I know that can be really scary, very challenging, and it's, you know, really, it takes courage to write out, I have this challenge and I've overcome it, or I'm working through these issues. It's critically important to use facts and you double check for accuracy. If you're interested in publishing an op-ed, contact the Respectability team. We're happy to give you all the numbers that you need. We just need your story. We always encourage people to always use person-first language. I know there's a lot of debate about what terms to use or not to use. We always encourage people to put respect first and foremost and say, you know, a person is a person first, their disability is second. When you introduce your topic, that should be written right there in your first paragraph. Think about that old-fashioned five-paragraph essay. Well, maybe op-eds are a little shorter, but you need to have your three key facts, communicate them, have stories that support those. And really, you know, we're talking very little words. We're talking maybe 500 for a really long op-ed. I mean, anybody has a story that can be summarized in 500 words, I think.
Let me interrupt at that point. One very effective way to do that, to communicate it, is, well, first of all, let me say that you have to make this real and seemingly feasible to the public officials. So you will get a reaction that public officials will not say outwardly, but they'll be thinking, say, that's really just too hard. I don't think that's possible. So come up with examples of ways that what you're proposing has worked in specific places in other places and ought to be tried in your location or in your state. One other way to do that is to, Respectability will get this to you, is to compare your state's labor participation rate among people with disabilities with other states. Those labor participation rates are published on an annual basis, state by state, and look up your state and then pick out a state that is doing better than your state is, that's sort of in the same region. So if you're in Wisconsin, say, look, Iowa has a much different experience. So why couldn't we at least do as well as Iowa? And that's a way of making it real. Otherwise, you get the reaction of, well, I'm sure we're doing the best we can. And your job is to show that we can all do better. Does that make sense, Philip?
Absolutely, and thank you, Steve. Another concrete thing is, as we mentioned, governors are a critical partner. If you're really interested in sending a letter and meeting with your governor, go to Respectability's website. We have form letters that you can use and adapt to go out there and make that connection. We meet with governors regularly every year, and it's critically important to talk to them about what they're doing, celebrate successes, challenge them if they're doing something that may not be the best that it could be, So a concrete example of another thing that we'd love for people to do is something called NDEAM, which is the National Disability Employment Awareness Month. So NDEAM is celebrated every October. And so last year, we reached out to all of the governor's offices to ask them about whether they're going to do a public event, doing a proclamation, or signing an executive order celebrating the talents and skills of employees with disabilities. In a lot of states, you have to be a constituent to make that kind of request. And so as we get closer to October, which is 4 months from now, we're going to be giving people materials to request that governors do something to celebrate National Disability Employment Awareness Month. So when I say that we're planning ahead to do a lot of work with our volunteers, you can tell we've already got plans for October, we already got plans for December. We're really excited about everything that we've got going. And so you heard a serious voice that has not spoken up yet. So who from Respectability is going to be coordinating volunteers? Who do you talk to if you have questions? I'll tell you this. I'm Philip Kanpali. I'm the data guy. If you have a question about policy, ask me. If you need to volunteer work, I'm not necessarily the person to ask. The person you want to ask is our brand new, absolutely amazing Director of Community Outreach and Impact, Debbie Fink. Good afternoon.
Hi, Philip, and everybody out there. It's a pleasure to be joining, and again, thanks to the board members and the volunteers who are listening for taking time out of your busy days to join us. And we're so pleased that you're going to join the ranks as we launch our Respectability Volunteer Corps nationwide. And you're part of a pilot study as we build and hone our best practices on this front. And to this end, we are very committed to eliciting and listening to your feedback and making the necessary changes as we grow our corps from sea to shining sea.
Absolutely. And so one of the first things that I would ask folks to do if they're really interested is you'll see a tab up on the right for shared files. We actually have a working draft volunteer handbook. It is a rough draft. There are pieces missing. There are parts that need to be filled in, but we want to get some feedback on it. We want folks to take a look at it, to download it, read through the material, see if it answers their questions or gives you a sense of the tremendous contribution that you're going to be able to make to our organization. It'll be posted on our website soon, but for those who are registered to attend today, I'll send you a copy of that by a PDF copy of that, as well as the slides from today. And we encourage you to download that handbook, really read through it, and really see the tremendous things we've got coming up for our new, brand new volunteer corps. We're getting close to the hour time limit, so I just want to be cognizant of that. Virginia, who is our lovely operator, could you quickly explain to anybody on the phone how to submit a question?
Participants who have dialed in on the phone can press 7 followed by the pound sign on their telephone keypad to indicate they'd like to ask a question. That's 7 followed by the pound sign on your telephone keypad. If you haven't dialed in, you could submit questions using the Q&A box. Type your message in the bottom of the Q&A box and click on the Ask button with your mouse to send it.
Gotcha. Thank you, Virginia. And in case anybody's got, we'll let people kind of filter in if they have questions. So I just want to quickly do a lightning round of volunteer questions with you, Debbie. How's that?
Sure, Philip. I'm ready when you are.
All right. So how much time can volunteers expect to commit to projects?
Well, the benefit of being a volunteer is that you can determine how much or how little time you want to invest in the effort. So, and with that said, obviously, if you commit to a time-sensitive task, we expect follow-through or to hear from you with enough time so we can reassign the task to another volunteer or to pivot accordingly.
Gotcha. And if a volunteer does work for us, how would they report their time and efforts?
We have several forms, actually, in the handbook. If you want, when you download the handbook, there are pages 31 through 36, and one of the forms will account for the time that you put in. Actually, we'll have it online to make it easier, but we're not quite there yet. So in order to get started with the volunteer process, we, as Philip mentioned, we want you to download our Volunteer Corps handbook, which Philip also mentioned is still a draft form, and we welcome all your feedback. Read the handbook, set up a call with me so we can determine mutually beneficial tasks, And then we need you to sign the required four documents that are in the handbook, as I said, between pages 31 and 36. And then once we receive those signed documents, we will roll up our sleeves and get to work.
All right. And how will volunteers be recognized for their contributions?
With a lot of gratitude from us and the mere satisfaction that you are making a difference in your community and nationwide for people with disabilities. And eventually, over time, we are going to be establishing a statewide representative, and then we'll be able to identify state-by-state Volunteer of the Year, and then we'll have a national Volunteer of the Year who we will honor at our annual Capitol Hill event. That's down the road. But we really are excited for every one of you to join and be a part of this, you know, fledgling group right now that is really going to grow before our very eyes and make a significant difference on behalf of people with disabilities in our country.
Thank you. And so, Debbie, as a final question, seeing nobody in the chat box and not seeing any phone questions, how can our volunteers get in touch with you?
In the handbook, there is my email and office phone number. Feel free to use it. My email, and it's on the slide so debbie@respectability.org. And then the office phone number should be there as well. So feel free to reach out, and I'll be in touch with you, and we can work out a really good dynamic that serves your purposes individually, professionally, personally, as well as ours.
Well, thank you so much, Debbie. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Janet. And thank you, Donna, for all of your contributions today. As I said at the very beginning, this is an inaugural effort. This is a pilot project demonstration, kind of exploration of how we're going to do this. We're going to figure out from there what feedback you have for us, how we're going to get our volunteers involved, how we're going to celebrate, how we're going to work together. We really appreciate your time and your interest. Thank you so much again. This is Philip Kahn-Polly with Respectability. We appreciate your interest in fighting stigmas and advancing opportunities for the 1 in 5 Americans who have disabilities. Thank you again, and we really appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Philip, for coordinating this.